You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
So, good morning, Matt. So, you should tilt your camera down because we're getting 95% of your hair, and we need 100% of your hair.
You want it up?
Yeah, we need all of it. Yes, okay. Yes.
In all its glory, Bill.
I mean, I'm loving this. This I think this is like this is like the peak. I had this problem myself because I think my hair should be this long, and
yeah,
you know, it's at the point where if you let it go like two more weeks, it's going to be too much, and
oh, it will be.
And this is where I find annoying because you have to go to the hair salon and basically admit, I want to keep this length. I feel like this is my ideal length, and I'm going to maintain this. It's not just you're letting it go and you're magically looking wonderful. You're actively choosing to keep that style.
Yeah.
But I do think you're at that maximum point.
I could do a whole show about hair. I really could. I've got lots of thoughts. And it's interesting you bring it up because I am supposed to meet with a... more than just a hairstylist, but really a hair consultant.
Oh wow, you're on a whole other level than me.
This is someone that my wife found on Instagram who amazingly lives in West Virginia, but is like respected in the hair industry. and there's going to be a consultation. Now, here's my concern: it's almost long enough though where I can do the man bun.
No.
And so you're nixing that though?
No man bun. No, absolutely not.
I'm not saying an everyday thing, but I would like to be able to pull it back. And it's not quite long enough to really, I mean, I tried it in my interview with Glenn Greenwald and it didn't take. So it wasn't quite there yet. It was too tight. You have to have a little looseness. You know this.
But this is the wrong path. Like, you should not overthink this. For the rush, you do have to think about it some, but don't overthink it.
Well,
what you have now is, you know, loose and fancy free. Matt Lewis living his best life.
I don't think I could have done this. And I was thinking, like, I wish I'd had longer hair when I was younger, because my editor's calling. I got it. Text him here in a second. I wish I'd had longer hair when I was younger because obviously when you're younger, you look better. and I could have really enjoyed the whole rebellious thing. But, you know, I don't think if you had to go into an office and like if you had to go into an office type work situation, as I've had to do at various points in my life, the awkward in-between area, I don't think I could have stuck it out when my hair was like, you know, but because I was like in West Virginia in a pandemic, you could put a baseball hat on or like even like a video, you know, you could pull it back or you're just seeing the front of me. You're not seeing like if I was on like TV, like on set, the cameras are coming from weird angles and it might look bad. So I think that because of this unique situation of a pandemic I was able to ride out the hard times. You know what I mean? Not that I'm in the promised land yet with the hair, but I think I was able to make it.
I mean, we could do especially for our podcast viewers, we could talk about hair for the next hour, which everybody wants us to do. But just one last question. So is the fact that your spouse is bringing in a highfalutin hair consultant, does that mean that does that mean, A, she's loving this and just wants to fine-tune it so it's at its absolute best, or B, this is a way of saying this is a total disaster and I need to bring in professional help to fix you?
No, she likes it. I would trust me. Like, I don't buy a T-shirt without my wife signing off on it. And she is the ultimate consultant of all things. And so, especially if anything to do aesthetically, I wouldn't do anything, you know, in terms of hair or clothing without her explicit sign off. So, she's totally down with it. And her hair now is, she hasn't You know, obviously it's a different vibe, but I mean, she hasn't cut her hair in the same amount of time I haven't. So hers is super long. And I think we've become those people, Bill. You know, it's a lifestyle. So here we are.
All right. So we are right.
No, wait. Before we turn to something serious.
Yeah.
We've got two other quick things that we need to talk about.
All right.
One is Thanksgiving, which we'll get to in a second. But are you familiar with D.B. Cooper by chance?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not obsessive, but I know the basic story. There's a very nice Todd Snyder song, D.B. Cooper. I know the basic story.
So we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of D.B. Cooper, of his escape. Well, we don't know. I just listened to this amazing podcast, but it was the day before Thanksgiving, 1971, 50 years ago. This guy, D.B. Cooper, for those who don't know, got on an airplane and hijacked it and stole, ransomed $200,000 and jumped with parachutes, jumped somewhere, I think, in Washington State or something, and was never heard from again. Now, here's the interesting thing. The $200,000, the serial numbers, that money never surfaced. It never went back into circulation, which would lead you to believe he died, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there were no missing persons. Like, it wasn't like somebody left work the week before Thanksgiving and never came back. There were nobody meeting his description at that time was reported missing. So this is an amazing mystery. And I've listened to, over the years, several podcasts, and I'm just, for some reason, fascinated by this story.
And as far as you know, those two facts that you gave me about the serial numbers, missing persons, those are both incontrovertibly true facts. There's no chance that someone got that wrong and that's throwing people off.
This is, according to my extensive research, but I could tell you the latest podcast I was listening to. But a couple years ago, I listened to the Stuff You Should Know guys, who had a good episode on it, and I was just listening to a show called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. They're my experience has been that they're very thorough, and their documentation. So, I will stand by what I've said until someone corrects me in the comments. Now, in fairness, there was like $5,000 of the money was recovered. I think a kid playing in the wilderness discovered $5,000 of it about 5 years later. So like, let's say 1976-ish, something like that. But the rest of the money never went back into circulation. And so And I think I'm intrigued by it partly because it's this mystery that we'll probably never know. And yet it wasn't utterly sinister. Like, the guy was kind of nice. You know, he was tipping, trying to tip the waitresses. He tried to pay for his food, you know, things like that. And he didn't hurt anybody. And so it's sort of like in this space of being something that's like dark and mysterious and yet didn't turn out to be horrific. It's an interesting mystery. You know, Bill, I try to take my mind sometimes off of politics. You know, I listen to a ton of political podcasts, and every once in a while, like something like this at a Thanksgiving time will take your mind. So I recommend it. Check that out.
All right.
So what are you doing? You're getting your booster shot soon, right?
Booster shot this morning. We can't talk forever. I do need to go get that. You know, I got to start doing Thanksgiving prep. I got to start cooking things. I got to do a little more cooking than I usually have to do, I think. And my wife's sister just moved to town, so she's going to take over some cooking. But I got on my shoulders this year. I'm doing the sweet potato casserole. I'm doing the mashed potatoes, and I'm doing the mac and cheese.
Are you good? Are you a good cook? You seem like you would.
I mean, I do. There are certain things I know how to do. I'm not someone who can do just about anything, and I'm not a maestro. But I do good mashed potatoes and I do good mac and cheese. The sweet potatoes is a new frontier for me, but it's not that hard. I should be able to pull it off.
Getting hungry just thinking about this.
I would not do a turkey well. I mean, I've tried at times, and like I never put the thermometer in the right spot, and so I never know when it's actually done.
So my wife started doing this thing called spatchcocking or something. Yeah, do you know about this?
I mean, I know about it. I mean, there's various turkey trends, you know, like deep frying was a thing, and then spatchcocking was a thing. And like
spatchcocking is good because it doesn't take as long mm-hmm. to cook the turkey. Mm-hmm. It's like half as much time or something, I think.
But the deep frying
thing is very dangerous.
Right.
Apparently. Right. So.
Yeah, I'm not one for overcomplicating it. But at the same time, I'm not the person who knows how to do it well, so I'm not the person to ask.
When I used to work at the Daily Caller, we used to deep fry a turkey on the streets of downtown Washington, like L Street or something, and feed the whole office. So I'm sure that violated some OSHA regulations, but we did it.
Well, I'm sure that was part of the fun.
Rebel.
So are you doing anything? Do you actually have to get your hands dirty and cook something?
No, nothing.
Do you bring in
another?
Is there a consultant you're bringing in to like do your food plan?
Do you remember how I used to have my Christmas tree delivered when I lived in the DC area?
It was embarrassing.
It was delivered.
I was ashamed to know you.
So we're going out to a fancy restaurant this year. We're not even doing it here. We do family stuff all the time, but we're not doing the thing. We're going out, Bill.
So
what do you think of that?
Also embarrassing. Now, do you have any family coming in? This is just nuclear family.
It's just nuclear family.
Okay. I mean,
just going out. Yeah.
It's like one time when my wife and I went out for Thanksgiving. And that's because we did kind of like a mini vacation. This was just the two of us. And we were living in San Francisco, and we drove down to LA. And we were like the one restaurant in LA that was open for Thanksgiving. And it wasn't like a big fancy restaurant. It was just like the restaurant that was open. And so we ate there.
Yeah. I've done it all. I've done it all over the years. And I mean, as a conservative, Bill, and someone I treasure and value, you know, family get-togethers and communal and all that.
Do you?
Which we do all the time.
Do you, Matt?
But Thanksgiving is a heavy lift. It's a lot of work. And in my household, the workload falls predominantly on my wife's shoulders.
Do you know what's also a lot of work, Matt? You know what's a lot of work?
Yeah.
America. America's a lot of work. And you've decided that work is too much for you, and someone else should do the work for you.
Well, I'd like to say that I'm helping stimulate the economy, and people who frankly don't want to be would prefer not to be home with their families will be serving us Thanksgiving, and we'll brighten their day a little bit.
Is there no part of your extended family that is saying, what the hell? Why do you hate us? Why aren't you coming over for our tradition? There's no friction there. You can just cut them off, and there's no collateral damage.
Well, I'm not cutting. We're not cutting anybody off. But we'll be together for Christmas.
Can they join right you away. At your restaurant? Are they invited or are they not invited?
They don't want to. They don't want to. I mean, I'm a romantic, you know, but I make sacrifices. So anyway. Thank you for having fun with that. And what should we talk about this week? Oh, By the way, I just interviewed our friend Josh Krausar.
Oh, great.
Of National Journal. And he does this thing every year that's the biggest political turkeys of the year. We just did a whole podcast on it. Terry McAuliffe ranks number one. So check that out.
Excellent. So I don't know if I want to talk about this, but I know that you penned an ode to Bill Maher for lashing out at Democrats for being too woke. And honestly, I saw the clip being pushed on Twitter. I was like, I'm not going to stomach this and watch it. When Bill Maher goes down this path, it always annoys me to no end. So I didn't want to waste 5 minutes out of my day watching it. And look, it's not like I'm the guy telling Democrats to go as far left as possible on every possible area. But my gut sense is, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I know everyone hates it when I haven't watched it, but I haven't watched it. The conflating of what certain Twitter randos do, or even certain activists, and saying this is what Democrats are doing, and this is Democrats' problem, like, that strikes me as being, way oversimplified. I mean, obviously there's some issues to discuss here, but I don't think Bill Maher does it in the most nuanced way, because he's going for the cheap laugh and the bombastic talking point.
Well, anytime you're going for the laugh, you have to. There is an art. This goes back to our Dave Chappelle special, which you didn't see. And in fairness to Bill, we do not plan the, like, you had no idea until 5 minutes ago we'd be talking about Bill Maher. So
right, we don't plan the show at all. There's no prep work. That's why I don't watch anything that I don't want to watch.
Actually, my wife and I just went to a great restaurant in D.C. For our anniversary. It's called Imperfecto, which I thought was a great name, because it's a fancy restaurant. But if they get anything wrong, it's like, well, it's called Imperfecto. What do you expect? You know, we should do Unplanned with Matt and Bill. But no, I mean, anytime you're telling a joke, you know, there's some artistic license involved. But I would say, I actually think that Bill Maher is nuanced and is in the main accurate. And look, this is a problem Democrats have, which is, you know, if the lady who did the 1619 project says something crazy or extreme, if the New York Times runs an editorial or an op-ed that says something crazy or extreme, if AOC does, or Rashida Tlaib, like, that will become relevant. And it may not be fair to conflate that with mainstream Democratic opinion, but it will become relevant, just like when, you know, Gosar or Marjorie Taylor Greene does or says something crazy. It tells you something about the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, if it's AOC or Tlaib, AOC and Tlaib are at least elected officials. So it's appropriate to go to a higher up Democratic leader. You know, do you agree with what this member of your caucus said? Tell us what the overarching political party position is. Since somebody in your party said X, do you agree? That's fair. Like, what's in the 1619 book is not the Democratic Party platform.
When people on the left tear down a statue of Thomas Jefferson or have it removed, as just happened, when people on the left attack Thanksgiving,
who's attacking?
And say it's nothing.
Was there a Thanksgiving attack? If this happened, I want to know. I'm not aware of the Thanksgiving attack.
Oh, I could pull it up. There was a guy on MSNBC, and MSNBC tweeted it out, mm-hmm. where he talked about how, like, Thanksgiving. You want me to put? It'll take me a few minutes. It might take me a minute to pull it up.
But basically, this is taking
Native
American land.
It's nothing more than Thanksgiving's nothing more than white supremacy and murdering natives, and, like, that's all Thanksgiving. When you eat your turkey this year, Bill, you're contributing to that. Okay, now when MSNBC tweets that out, when leftist activists have Thomas Jefferson statue removed from a museum or whatever just happened. When that happens, voters and normal Americans, average Americans who are not, you know, who are not political activists, who are not political commentators, they they will attribute that, fairly or not, to the Democratic Party. And like, it may not be fair, but that's what happens. And so Bill Maher comes in and I think offers sincere criticism, which is like, hey, people, if you ever, you know, this is how Trump wins. If you want to elect Trump, keep acting like this.
So when Bill Maher is Islamophobic, and when Bill Maher is transphobic, and when Bill Maher is anti-religion, his whole freaking documentary being anti-religion, do the Democrats own that because Bill Maher sometimes donates to Democrats? I mean, he's a problem.
He gave $1 million to Obama.
So do they
Bill
own,
Maher gave $1 million
do they own
to
every,
Obama's
do they own every offense that Bill Maher has said? Of course not. So, you know, Bill Maher should really think about, you know, what he does that affects the Democratic Party, because he's been a problem at times, and Republicans have tried to yoke him with the Democrats before. You know, if he truly cares predominantly about Democrats winning, which he claims to care about, he claims to be the electoral pragmatist in the room, he should be making the distinctions and saying, hey, MSNBC is not the Democratic Party. 1619 is not the Democratic Party. And if it's a case of an elected official, he can even go as far as say, you know what? AOC is not the speaker. AOC is not the president. She's one person elected in one district and doesn't speak for the entire party. But he doesn't do that. He wants to always be the guy who's telling the truth and never talks about his own problematic statements, his own complicated statements that are difficult to defend, which is all fine and good for a guy who is paid to get people to watch his show. I mean, his fundamental job is not electing Democrats. His fundamental job is to get eyeballs, which he does. But I don't think that makes his critique the true critique.
So I think that at this moment, he may be, and I said he may be like the most important conservative voice. Now, he's calls himself an old school liberal, but I think he's trying to conserve liberalism. And so my argument is, when the defining issues of our time were things like, you know, abortion or gay marriage or even like marijuana legalization, he lined up differently. But now that the kind of like the scolds, the puritanical scolds are not really predominantly the religious right, but the woke left, who are kind of policing what you can and cannot say. And like, I mean, this is a guy who was literally canceled, you know, one time already. I think that he is sort of serving as this contrarian voice, and he's more effective at it than I would be for a variety of reasons. One, I think comedians tend to be kind of smarter and more quick-witted than writers. I'm much better after multiple edits and, you know, getting to say it just right. But that actually leads to the second reason he's very effective, is he does have writers and editors, and a lot of his commentary is done in a way that he can control. He's not the now he just was on Chris Cuomo's show, but generally he's not the guest on his show. He is controlling to a large degree who the guests are, the tone of the show, the topic. So that allows him to, I think, present things very favorable to him and precisely as he wants to do them. And I also think, as someone who actually comes from the left, that, you know, he's not going to be stereotyped as a conservative, as a boring conservative, or as a stodgy conservative. He's got this, you know, irreverent style, and also the bona fides of being a liberal who gave $1 million to Obama's PAC. Like, I think for all of these reasons, he has emerged at this moment when the predominant critique has to do with the woke left. He has emerged as a dominant voice, if not the dominant
voice. I mean, he has a loud voice. He has a platform. I don't think it's a platform that is, for Democrats to win. Democrats, particularly in the midterms are already going to be uphill for Democrats. But as a general matter, for Democrats to win, they have, for any party to win, you have to unite your base and win the middle. You know, there was a school of thought that the middle doesn't exist anymore and it's all about base turnout. I think that has been demonstrably proven wrong. I mean, there may be fewer swing voters than in the past, but they still exist and they're still important. So you got to find a way to unify the base and win the middle at the same time. Bill Maher, as a political strategist, does not help that cause because he drives wedges in the Democratic coalition. He doesn't unify.
If he did the things you want him to do, he would come across as a political hack.
His job is not to be a political strategist. His job is not to run the DCCC. So if he wants to speak his own view and pop off, he obviously has the right, but I'm not going to take his HBO monologue and make it the game plan for Democrats to win elections, because what he does makes it harder for Democrats to unify. Joe Biden threaded the needle. Joe Biden doesn't run around talking about reparations and critical race theory, but he knew how to talk about systemic racism. He knew when to pick a spot and say, you know what? Open the Supreme Court, that's going to a black woman. You know, no bones about it. While also pointing out that he's white working class, he's been looked down upon, he's been condescended to, and that makes him mad. So he was able to talk about racism without making white people feel like I'm taking a pound of flesh out of you to help somebody else. That's not zero sum.
And I think Bill Maher would say that's what the Democrats in general should be doing, but that's not what they're doing. I mean, he had a whole thing this weekend where he talked about, like, you know, whites are still like 70% of the population or something, depending on how you talk about, quote, white Hispanics and all that. So whites are still a majority. And yet, you know, Bill Maher says, like, if you listen to Democrats, it's like they think the average voter is like a teenage Guatemalan immigrant on TikTok or something like that. And like,
these are not helpful comments to unify the Democratic Party.
Well, no, I think they are. I think they are helpful, Bill, because look, if Bill Maher was trying to get elected, then he might have to try to, like, say nice things that thread the needle, but don't actually confront the problem.
What?
The Democratic Party has a real problem. Someone needs to. I think he's speaking truth to power. I think he is telling them what they need to hear, which he is liberated to do by virtue of the fact that he's not trying to get their vote.
There are three big things that Democrats have done in the past year, legislatively speaking. American Rescue Plan, infrastructure bill, and I presume by the end of the year, Build Back Better. One of those three things is overly focused on Guatemalan immigrants on TikTok. These are all broad bills. They're not race-based bills. They're targeted right at the broad middle class. I hope you'll get into the middle class. There's hope. A lot of these things, quite frankly, are pretty poll-tested kind of things. So what is it that, I mean, it's fine to talk about what people on Twitter might push or certain activists might push. What are Washington Democrats doing that is overly focused on small slivers of the electorate and not the broad middle?
My argument would be that all the things you just described are basically irrelevant. I mean, you know, Build Back Better polls well, but Biden's approval ratings are very low, and Democrats just lost the race, you know, in Virginia, and Republicans are poised to take the House. And I think that legislative accomplishments are not that important anymore in the sense of what voters care about. It seems like the culture is what matters. And I think you put too much stock in, like, legislative accomplishments when really this cultural milieu is what's driving opinions and voter preference.
I don't wholly disagree with that. I certainly agree that just passing the bill, I mean, just as a matter of plain fact, hasn't moved the needle for Democrats opinion-wise. I mean, that's just plain as day. But as far as trying to critique what are Democrats doing that's right or wrong, I don't see what you can say that they're what are they doing that makes them look like people obsessed with tiny pockets of millennials. I mean, their agenda is not that, and even at the very base level, look at who won mayoral elections in blue cities. I mean, they're still Democrats. But Eric Adams and Byron Brown Buffalo and Jacob Frey in Minneapolis and Bruce Harrell in Seattle. I mean, these are Democrats voting for generally moderate Democrats in the bluest parts of the country. The slight exception is Michelle Wu in Boston, which is a more college educated majority minority city, but even she is not, you know, off the rails woke. She's more like an Elizabeth Warren progressive. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we necessarily agree. I don't think we necessarily disagree. I think that, you know, Democrats may be doing legislatively, and it may well be that the silent majority of Democrats are Joe Biden Democrats, but they have a message problem. And here's the thing. Here's a point that Bill Maher actually made recently. I can't remember where. But I used to say, when I was talking to Republicans, I would say, like, it doesn't matter if your policies are going to benefit Hispanics. If they think you hate them, then you can't talk to them, right? Bill Maher made this same point basically about white people, that, like, Democrats, you can say all day long that your, you know, policies are going to help working class whites, and maybe they will. But if the impression is that you want to help everybody else except them, that you really don't like them, and that you think that, you know, that they're, you know, we're going to divide the country into, like, victims and oppressors, it doesn't matter if your policies benefit them or even if your policies are substantive. Like, if they feel like you hate them, and I think that's the state of play today.
Well, I don't want to go around in circles and just repeat ourselves, but my concern with Bill Maher is he is, I will agree that Democrats have a message problem right now, otherwise they'd be doing better. Their numbers would be better. One, I think it is wrong to wholly attribute that to this quote-unquote woke issue, because there's the inflation issue. There's the fact that Democrats spent 6 months arguing amongst themselves, and there just was a focus group report on in Politico about how even Biden voters think all Democrats do is fight with each other. I think that has to do with the day-to-day sausage-making over the past several months, which is not really about woke stuff. You know, so there's other big things out there that I think are arguably more important than this issue. And to the extent that the woke stuff is an issue, it's because disingenuous people are attributing comments to Democrats, even if elected Democrats and Democratic leaders aren't making them. And Bill Maher is contributing to that conflation as opposed to clarifying things and separating the comments from people who are actually running for office.
All right. That's an interesting point. And I want to keep exploring that, but we should move on because of time. And Bill, you know, I talked to our friend Josh Krausar about the turkeys, the Thanksgiving turkeys of 2021. And Terry McAuliffe was number one. I think Kamala Harris was number three. And
who's,
I know you've
who,
been.
Who was two? On. Who was two?
Two is Eric Greitens, or not Greitens. Who's the Pennsylvania guy?
Oh, Sean Parnell.
Two is Sean Parnell. Mm-hmm. So I think number one is Terry McAuliffe. Two is Sean Parnell. Mm-hmm. Three is Kamala Harris. I know one group is Arizona Republicans. And the last group was like, this actually proves your point, Bill. Mm-hmm. I think the last group, I think, was sort of like AOC Democrats who ran and lost mm-hmm. this year. There were a mm-hmm. lot of AOC endorsed candidates who did not fare well.
India Walton, Nina Turner.
Yep. So okay, anyway,
Pramila Jayapal's Seattle mayoral candidate lost that mayoral race.
Oh, to a Republican, right?
No, to a Democrat. I mean, it was a nonpartisan race. They're both Democrats, but the mayoral candidate who won was the more moderate, police friendly candidate. There was a Republican city attorney race in Seattle, and that Republican was a recent convert. She was a Democrat like 3 years ago, but she ran on a pro police platform, and she had an even more left wing opponent than in the mayor's race. And she won that race. And it's Seattle, you know, this is not even like New York City is a very big city. You know, it has Staten Island. It has lots of working class areas. It's not Boston, which, you know, just the Boston, you know, Southie is really a very small part of Boston. But Seattle, I mean, this is, you're talking about, this is literally a hop, skip, a jump from Portlandia, you know, and they're electing more moderate Democrats because that's where the bulk of the party is. Anyway.
HBO needs to give Bill Scherer equal time.
Anyway, but Kamala. So I have a piece in the queue at the Washington Monthly. I think it's going to go up tomorrow, where I'm basically defending Kamala. Now, I don't necessarily think it's wrong for Josh to have put her on this list. She's not had a good year. Her numbers are worse than Biden's, and Biden's numbers aren't all that good. And there are people openly talking about how she doesn't have a clear shot at, you know, 2024, 2028, whatever it is that Biden doesn't run. So you can't argue that she's doing politically well right now. But what I think people are not considering is that no vice president does great. There's no one who like really killed it as vice president. You know, everyone's had issues. Everyone's had challenges. It's just an inherently complicated political position to be in, to have to be the consummate loyalist while also defining your own political brand at the same time. And nobody walks that line perfectly. And it's extraordinarily rare for a sitting vice president to succeed the president. I mean, it's literally, ever since we've had the 12th Amendment, it's happened twice. It's Martin Van Buren and George H.W. Bush. Now, that doesn't mean it's bad to be vice president, because over the course of all of history, one out of three vice presidents do become president eventually. You know, sometimes that's because the president dies, the president resigns, or they get there after there's a little bit of distance from their vice presidency. So yeah, I think you'd rather be vice president than almost anything else in the universe if you want to be president. But it's an inherently fraught place to be, and I just don't think we are judging Kamala on the same plane as we judge other vice presidents.
That's fair. I think I would argue, though, it's not because of sexism or racism, but the expectations for her, I would say two things. One, the expectations for her were very high. And also, because Joe Biden is old, and there was talk about him being just a transitional president.
Right.
So there was a real need to have a bench, someone waiting in the wing.
Right.
So I think that made her, it raised the, maybe not expectations, but like the importance.
No, I think expectations is the right word.
Yeah, they really needed her to be ready for prime time.
Well, let me put a finer point on that. I don't think you can take race and gender out of that equation. You know, she's a first, and people expect too much of first. You know, you're somebody Jackie Robinson. If you're not Jackie Robinson, you're a punk, and that's not a fair expectation to put on somebody. You know, she's a normal human being in a very difficult position, namely vice president. Yeah,
but in this case, I mean, it's not like people are looking at her as a black woman and saying a black woman could never be president. It's that they're looking at her as a black woman saying, we really need her. We really need her to do great. Right.
But it's still pressure. And I still think you can't remove the race and gender out of that. It's still part of it. And number two, and I think this is very underlooked. There are basically two kinds of vice presidents. There's the vice president that has more Washington experience than their president and the kind that has less. And we've been on a pretty long streak of presidents who are fully or quasi outsiders who haven't been in the game all that long. And they pick an old Washington hand to be their number two to be reassuring before Election Day. And we haven't had the reverse, the elder statesman and, you know, the young upstart. That hasn't happened since Dan Quayle. It's literally 1988. So it's 30 plus years, right?
That's a good point. And it didn't bode well for Dan Quayle.
You look back 100 years. There's only, not kind of comma, there's only four.
Yeah, and by the way, I would say Palin wasn't vice president, but the model.
She was that model.
Would have been the Palin model. And the same thing, Palin was Dan Quayle in a way.
Well, I mean both Quayle and Palin had rocky vice presidential candidacies. You know, so they come into office already, you know, five demerits down. Kamala had a good candidacy. Kamala's rollout was very good. She didn't have a big gaffe in the general election campaign. I don't think that's fair, though.
Palin's rollout was amazing.
Well, like the first
Palin's rollout,
Palin's first 48 hours was better than Quayle's 48 hours. But
no,
Palin,
you're forgetting, man. Palin's rollout, this is like lost to history. Palin had a great rollout. And she gave a great speech at the Republican convention.
And everything was downhill.
And she held her own in a debate against Joe Biden.
That debate wasn't so great.
But here's the thing. Kamala got to hide because of this global pandemic. If Sarah Palin had been operating in a scenario where she could do Zoom calls from the basement, it might have been easier to protect her. I don't know.
Joe Biden made his gaffes in interviews. I mean, you still can make gaffes in interviews. If Sarah Palin was talking to Katie Couric via Zoom, she still might have said the same dumb things. So I don't know if I can credit that.
Shouldn't have been talking to Katie Couric.
But you go back the last 100 years, you can only find four other vice presidents who are of the lesser Washington experience model. And that's being a little bit generous with the definition. It's basically Calvin Coolidge. Calvin Coolidge was who'd only visited Washington twice before he was nominated. Then you have Nixon, and Nixon, I'm being a little generous because, you know, Eisenhower was a general. He wasn't a legislator. So Nixon had 6 years more legislative experience than Eisenhower did, 6-0. But Nixon was 39 years old when he was nominated, and Eisenhower just won the World War.
Invasion.
Right. Anyway, you know, he was Supreme Commander, he was Army Chief of Staff. He navigated Washington in a certain way that Nixon had very little experience with. So there's that. Spiro Agnew also never had a Washington office. And interestingly, Eisenhower never loved Nixon, and Nixon never loved Agnew. And both Eisenhower and Nixon thought about bumping their VPs. Agnew self-imploded with his own bribery scandal. But, you know, Nixon had the Checkers thing. He had the slush fund scandal that he solved with Checkers. Eisenhower thought about dumping him over that in 52. And then even floated with Nixon directly, him being bumped off the ticket in 56. Because he just never, they just never really clicked. I would take
a Supreme Court appointment.
Well, Eisenhower floated cabinet to Nixon. In fact, Eisenhower said to Nixon, you know, no one's ever become president after being 8 years of vice president. So really, it's good for you if you take a cabinet post. And Nixon was like, no, I'm not falling for that one. you're not getting rid of me. So it's Calvin, Nixon, Agnew, and Quayle. Those are the four. That's it. So Kamala doesn't come into office with this wide network of personal relationships in D.C., not a ton of friends, not a relationship with Washington reporters. And so it's very easy for fellow Democrats to pounce on her and point to her as the problem. Whereas like a Walter Mondale has had a lot of friends in DC. And so when Carter had his own problems, be like, hey, this Walter Mondale guy doesn't look so bad. You know, Kamala's not getting that benefit when Biden's hitting the skids because she looks like a bigger rookie than he does.
Yeah. And it's partly because, let's be honest, she was picked for demographic reasons. I mean, Biden said he was going to pick a woman. Like, months before he picked a woman, that was basically a pledge. So that limits, like, by half the choices you have. And I think, obviously, he wanted a younger person, someone youngish. You know, Kamala's hope was to be, like, the young, exciting, charismatic, you know, future.
That's right.
And I don't think hasn't risen to the occasion, well, but
it's very hard to be that person when you're number two. That's just a really tough spot to be in. And so my takeaway from it all is, she's not going to give a I Have a Dream speech while she's number two. Like, just the position doesn't lend itself to that. And if she did one that amazing, then it would be she was grandstanding and she was overshadowing Biden, and that would cause its own problems. You know, the job is primarily to be a loyalist, and being a loyalist is not a way you get to really show off your best stuff. So I think you have to, if you're Kamala, you have to say, look, I'm going to get hammered. I'm VP. VPs get hammered. They're going to second guess. And I'm going to make my own mistakes. I'm not going to be perfect. No one avoids all gaffes. Look what happened in France. She did a, you know, basically every time Kamala said bad press, it's after a foreign trip. She really hasn't had anything colossally off. She hasn't misspelled potato, you know? She hasn't, like, really super duper blown it.
I don't know why that's, we've had this talk before. Yeah. I don't know why that's colossally bad either.
I mean, Quayle already had a reputation of as being a dim bulb, and that was just like, boom, like nail in the coffin. Never recovering from. Now Kamala made her own gaffe at her Guatemala Mexico trip. When talking about going to the border and being defensive about that, she did a trip to Singapore where some conservative outlets were giving her a hard time. I can't remember what the exact incident was off the top of my head, but it was smaller potatoes than the Guatemala thing. And then France, she's given this one talk to French scientists. An RNC Oppo guy does a 20-second clip of it where, you know, it's not Kamala at her very best, but it's a very tiny clip. And he characterizes Kamala Cringe Harris as talking to scientists like toddlers. And then Kathleen Parker does a column which says that she was talking to scientists like they were children without citing the RNC clip. It doesn't link to it herself. And then says, like, you know, what she said wasn't even French. She wasn't speaking French. She was speaking English. Now, it turns out that Kamala does speak some French. She actually went to a French-speaking school as a teenager in Montreal, but she's not fluent. And so she'd use her French very sparingly while she was in France. She used it once when she visited a cookware store and was talking to the shop clerk there. And the reporter from the LA Times, who was on the trip, is covering the trip, his coverage of her was very positive and said that she made a good impression when she went out amongst the people. And he was kind of saying, why it was too bad she didn't have more moments like this, because she was at her most relaxed and engaging when she got out of the bubble. But they had such a tight bubble on that trip because they're trying to avoid gaffes and didn't want to have a problem like they had in Guatemala. So my point is that there are certain people out there looking to cause trouble, looking to take things out of context and twist the knife in her, even when she's not even doing something all that bad. Yeah. But sometimes she's going to make a mistake because she's a human being and vice presidents are tricky positions. And she's just going to have to weather that, knowing in the back of her head that no matter how bad this gets, a vice president still has a leg up on just about anybody else running for this position. They almost win every presidential primary, and eventually, more than any other type of position, get to the presidency. So you're gonna have to just handle it with grace, but a lot of this nonsense is gonna be inevitable.
Well, look, I think two things can be true. I think you are certainly right that the vice presidency is a difficult job and pretty much a thankless job, not worth a warm bucket of spit and all that. But I also think Kamala doesn't have it, does not have it, whatever it is. But maybe I'll be proven wrong.
I mean, did Martin Van Buren have it? Did George H.W. Bush have it? These are the only two examples of people succeeding their presidents as vice president.
And well, the Van Buren doesn't count. That's a different media.
Sure. But George H.W. Bush, this was not the best guy on the stump. Had plenty of gaffe issues as vice president.
But he gets Reagan's third term. So the analogy, you know, there's no Reagan. You know,
I mean, Biden might be Reagan after 8 years. We don't know yet. I mean, in 1982, when we were in a recession and the Republicans had a terrible midterm, I mean, actually, at that point, people started speculating that maybe Reagan wouldn't run again. He was old for the time. I mean, he wasn't old.
William, you tweeted that William Sapphire. That's right. It was pretty hard hitting.
Yeah, I mean, Sapphire actively said Reagan shouldn't run again. There was other chatter about that at the time. And people started to poll who would get the nomination if Reagan didn't run. And it was basically between Bush and Senate Majority Leader Howard Baker, maybe it was Minority Leader, I forget which time. And it was neck and neck between the two of them. Like, Bush wasn't clearing the field. He was like in the 20s, and Baker was in the 20s, and a lot of, you know, I don't know. A lot of conservatives did not trust George H.W. Bush at that point. He was the moderate balancer on that ticket. And the party was still pretty conservative, and they weren't leaping to George Bush being the next in line. And even when someone was quoted in Politico, Kamala's not going to clear the effing field. Well, who did? You know, George Bush in '88 had to run against Bob Dole and Jack Kemp and Pat Robertson. Yeah. He did a very good job and won most of the contest, but he was greeted in that race from Newsweek calling him the wimp, fighting the wimp factor after 8 years of being number two. You know, Lee Atwater in '84, this is after Reagan wins re-election in a landslide, does a memo for Bush saying, hey, guy, when you ran 1980, the press called you a man of substance, and now they just call you a cheerleader. You know, you're losing your brand being number two, and we got to do things to fix this. And they weren't easily fixed. He was still called a wimp, you know, eight years after. But still better to be number two to Reagan than be anybody else, and he won. So,
becomes Reagan, then Kamala's chances, I think, increase dramatically. If Biden gets terms and he's, you know, the next Reagan, that's a different story. Remember, Bush ran against Michael Dukakis, not exactly Mr. Charisma.
How good is the Republican bench right now? They could put up a total numbnut. That column might look good in comparison to.
Totally. Look, you're right. I mean, sometimes people win just because they, you know, they don't have to be Demosthenes to win. Sometimes it depends on the political environment and who the opponent is and all sorts of things. So, like, Kamala could end up, you know, slouching her way to Pennsylvania Avenue on her own, and she may never be a great politician, and she still could win based on the fact that, statistically speaking, what, 1 in 3 chance? Is that what it is?
I mean, over the course of history, yeah. Now, but the vice president, when you make the bet to be vice president, I mean, you know, and Mondale said this to Carter, Mondale was the first vice president to have a West Wing office. To be treated as that integral to the White House operation, because he negotiated and asked for it, and he, what he said to Carter in laying out his vision for it, he said, look, my political future is intertwined with yours, so your success is my success, and I want you to be as successful as possible, and therefore I have an interest in helping you as best I can. And I think any person taking that position knows that going in. I mean, there's some people thinking about how is Kamala going to backstab Biden? I'm like, that's idiotic. Like, her fate is intertwined with his. And Biden, if Biden wants to pass the torch to somebody, it's her. The notion that, well, Kamala's not doing so great, and so let's look at Pete Buttigieg over here. that primary would be a freaking bloodbath if that comes to bear, especially if Buttigieg boxed out the first black female vice president. That's going to cause a lot of heartache in the Democratic base. It's in Biden's interest to avoid that kind of bloodletting and to help Kamala. It doesn't serve his interest to like give her terrible assignments. It's not her interest to screw things up for him. But she has to know that if Biden's having a terrible 48 years, she might be out of luck. And that's out of her control because she made the bet to have her fate be tied in with his.
All right. Well, it's going to be fun. And we talked about a couple of our turkeys of the bill. I have to go. I really have to go to a fancy lunch and to get my hair blown out and consulted.
Normal West Virginia things.
Typical West Virginia stuff. And I know you've got to go get jabbed.
Yeah.
But good news, by the way. I did. When you first get your first vaccine, it takes a couple weeks to kick in before you're fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
I just learned that the booster shot kicks in almost immediately. So by Thanksgiving, you're going to be like Superman. So.
All right. Well, let's see. I never suffered any side effects from the first two. I don't know if it'll happen the third or not. But I saw one doctor.
Let me say I didn't have any side effects from the first two and the booster. So it wasn't bad.
And it was the same shot. It was all one brand.
Yeah. Okay. All the same.
Okay.
So anyway, just take it easy is all I'm saying.
All right.
Don't get worked up.
I got to make my dishes.
You might want to, delegate that to the others.
That might be hard. Anyway, well, I'll get it out. Like Kamala Harris, I'll get it out.
We'll do it live. All right. Another great show, Bill. Have a happy Thanksgiving and we will reconvene next week.
And a happy Hanukkah. Hanukkah starts Sunday night. I got to make my donuts.
That's early.
It's a little early.
Wow, that's early.
I mean, there was one that actually overlapped with Thanksgiving not too long ago, but it is on the early side.
Wow. Well, happy Hanukkah, happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you back here next week in the DMZ.
All right, take care.